You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato, and for the rest of the hour, we're going to be continuing our discussion with Jerome Groopman, who's the Dina and Raphael Recanati Chair of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and a Chief of Experimental Medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. He's written a new book called The Anatomy of Hope, in which he explores through the lives of his patients how hope gives some strength to face a difficult diagnosis and a demanding course of treatment, while others sink into despair. Dr. Groopman, can you give us some idea of the range of hope? I'm first asking you how you define hope. Is it different for everybody what hope is?
Well, first, hope and optimism are often confused. An optimist says everything's going to turn out just fine. That's the way he sees the world. But in fact, we know that things often don't turn out just fine. Hope is different. Hope is clear-eyed. It has no illusions. It sees all the difficulties, all the problems in a very realistic way that we face. And then through those troubles, through those problems, it sees a possible path to a better future. And when you see that path, you figure that path out in your mind, there's a tremendous emotional response, which changes the chemistry of the brain and some physiology of the body. But it is different for every person in terms of both the capacity to find it, as well as what it enables the person to do, how it may act as a catalyst.
Mm-hmm. Our number 1-800-989-8255. You say that hope has a clear eye; it shows a possible path for being better. Yet you do talk about some patients in your book in which you didn't believe, or everybody in that situation didn't believe the person who was making the right decision. I'm specifically talking about one case with George Griffin, who was a Harvard professor. He was an expert on stomach cancer, and he diagnosed himself, basically, as you describe it, in having the most fatal form of cancer, and he chose to go down a road, take the most radical kind of chemotherapy that everyone thought he was never going to make it. Yet he had that hope that he thought he would.
Very much so. I was a young oncologist on the staff. And George, as you said, was the chairman of the pathology department and a world's expert in stomach cancer. And I could not figure out, nor my young colleagues, why he would subject himself to this kind of toxic treatment. He wasn't in denial. He actually planted bulbs, which would flower in the spring, expecting that they would be at his funeral. And I thought he was just irrational.
Mm-hmm.
And then 18 years later, when I started to work and write on the book.
18 years later, yeah.
18 years later, I sat in the hospital cafeteria having lunch with George and interviewing him for the book. And I said, you know, if I had been your doctor, you would be dead. And he said, I know that. You and most of the other staff.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, sometimes the tumor doesn't read the textbook. I knew the odds were very, very long, but nothing in medicine, nothing in biology is written in stone. And for me, I had to try. I had to go for that very, very small percentage. And he taught me, first of all, never to write someone off from the start, sort of a priori. And the second is that there is sort of a libertarian aspect to hope, that each person has the right to make a choice that makes sense for him or her in terms of how much to do.
Mm-hmm. You also write about patients who did not have hope. Tell us about one of those, for example, and what you learned from them.
Well, one woman is named Esther Weinberg. I was a third-year medical student at the time on the surgery service. She was a young, attractive woman from an Orthodox Jewish family. She was married with three children in her late 20s. She came to surgery with a large breast mass, the size of a walnut. And it made no sense to me that a woman of intelligence and with a family would allow a tumor to grow to this size without seeking medical attention. And I thought, you know, I come from a similar background, a traditional Jewish background. I'm going to have her confide in me and figure out what's going on here. And that was a very sort of arrogant, hubristic kind of approach. And she confided in me and told me that she was having an affair with her employer. She had no illusion he loved her. But she was suffocating in her marriage. She was unhappy in her life. And this was her escape. And now God was punishing her for her sin of adultery by giving her cancer. And in a very chilling way, it showed me what happens when someone believes there is no hope. She thought she was undeserving of hope. She thought she was totally at the mercy of forces outside of her, that she had no control. And unfortunately, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy because she died.
Mm-hmm. What do you take away from that?
I think it's very, very important for a physician to probe and know whether a person is finding true hope or not, how much hope the person has, how it's cast in terms of their own beliefs and needs. And for a patient who's facing severe illness, who can't find hope, it's as important to work with that person to find hope as any medication you'll prescribe or any procedure you'll perform.
Is there any evidence that just the hope itself increases the positive outcome?
Well, this is a very complex question. I actually retreated from any consideration that hope could help because so often it's depicted in the popular mind as a magic wand. You know, if you just meditate, your cancer goes away, or if you laugh, lupus goes into remission. And that's not true. On the other hand, I understand hope in two ways in terms of helping someone prevail. One is that it gives a person the courage to embark on a treatment and can sustain the strength they need to endure it. So it has a psychological effect, which can be very important. We see that in patients who have no hope. They don't fight. They don't try. Mm-hmm. And the second is that certain clinical issues, important clinical issues, can be affected by hope. And there's research that I discovered in writing this book that speaks to it. Pain, for example. Pain is often one of the greatest obstacles for a patient. And belief and expectation can markedly reduce the amount of pain that someone is experiencing and have them endure treatment much more effectively.
Mm-hmm. Why ever discourage anybody from having too much hope?
Well, I've been guilty of giving people false hope. I write about that in the book. I sort of swung wildly during my early career, initially following the lead of some of my teachers, where we would not tell the truth to a patient. We would omit key bits of information or use medical jargon to say to someone with colon cancer that had gone to the liver that we have effective drugs and you might go into remission. Well, a patient hears that and that means I may be cured. But what it really means is it may slow things down. Mm-hmm. And when you give someone false hope purposefully, ultimately it blows up in everyone's face. And the person feels misled and hasn't had the information with which to make choices about what he or she wants in terms of their treatment and how to use the time they may have left.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the flip side, putting too much emphasis on statistics. You talk about a patient, Claire Allen, had no, leaving the patient with no hope.
After I sort of felt very guilty about a person I gave false hope to, whom I write about in the book, I sort of, as I say, swung in the opposite direction, and I just sat there and said, well, you know, the mean survival is 6 months and the median survival is 9 months. And, well, when someone hears that, what they hear is this is a death sentence. Mm-hmm. You're telling them they're going to be dead in 6 to 9 months, and no one is God. No one can say that. And it completely colors the time that they have. So I look to the patient to give a lead, basically, to give enough information to be truthful, but to find a place where truth and hope can coexist.
True hope.
True hope. And true hope, I think, is absolutely vital in terms of a patient's experience of illness, both in terms of giving them a chance to be cured, and if cure is not possible, then really speaking to the quality of their life and, if we can use spiritual terms, sort of nourishing or comforting their soul.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Jerome Groopman, author of the new book, The Anatomy of Hope, How People Prevail in the Face of Illness. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. 8255. Lisa in Portland. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Dr. Groopman, I've read a lot of your pieces in New Yorker, and I think a lot of us wish we had clinicians, you know, more like you than different. But I have a slightly different take on the concept of hope. When you're dealing with people who have been given a death sentence, whether, you know, short-term, medium-term, long-term, or something concrete like tumors, you're dealing with one type of, again, concrete eventuality. I was wondering if you could speak more to those of us who are dealing with either orphan problems or sequelae, you know, leftovers from an illness of many years ago, where nobody publishes and nobody goes to school to specialize in us because there's so few of us around. And in my case, I had a severe viral encephalitis that was supposed to be fatal when I was in college. And 25 years later, a lot of the symptoms are recurring on me. And I still am encountering a lot of resistance to just try some things with some of my physicians, because there's no body of evidence to back anybody up.
Interesting. Dr. Groopman? Yeah.
I think this is a very important point. People with chronic illness or with rare illness or illness that's not well understood, and I think there are two points to make related to hope. One is that sometimes a scientific discovery made in one field importantly informs something in another field. For example, there's something called tumor necrosis factor, or TNF, which a lot of people, when I was in my early training in cancer medicine, thought was going to be a very important protein in cancer. Turned out that all of the work on TNF in cancer was for naught. But a blocker of TNF, which is called Enbrel, turns out to be an extremely effective treatment for severe rheumatoid arthritis. It's revolutionized the lives of people with this autoimmune disease and has allowed them to function at a much, much higher level. So sometimes people with problems in one field are benefited from another. In terms of a rare disease, I think there are two things. One is what you're asking your physician to do is important and reasonable. You want hope, and hope is giving you the courage to take risks, and those can be prudent risks, and you can sign an informed consent, you can document that, and try something. And the other is you can offer yourself as the study subject at the NIH or a center like that that specializes in rare diseases to try to figure out why you're still suffering 25 years later.
Well, I hear what you're saying, especially about the cross-pollinization factor. Unfortunately, it's not so much a rare disease as it is a disease that would have been treated if I'd had it 2 years later. But the treatment wasn't developed. The acyclovir treatment wasn't developed for the encephalitis until 2 years later. So I'm a walking statistic, but there's no future in looking at the sequelae of a disease that now is very treatable.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to engage, I'm not trying to be too personal, but just trying to engage physicians, clinicians who practice day in, day out into these types of intellectual exercises when they have all the burdens of managed care and caseloads, and I have good insurance, is a challenge I haven't really figured out quite how to cope with.
I don't minimize it, and I agree with you, but I still think I wouldn't give up because it's clear that the quality of your life is being compromised by this. And I think you could, for example, I mean, to give a concrete suggestion, is I think you could write to the National Institutes of Allergy, Immunology, and Infectious Disease, NIAID, and you could say, this is what I have. Is there a program? Is there a place I can get a second opinion? Can I, mm-hmm. in some way, get information which will at least give my local physicians a platform upon which to try something,
mm-hmm.
And to track work that might be going on in this field.
Yeah, good luck to you, Lisa. Thanks for calling. We're talking with Dr. Jerome Groopman, who is author of The Anatomy of Hope, How People Prevail in the Face of Illness, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Dr. Groopman, do you feel yourself now like the burden of the world on your shoulders since writing this book? Everybody is coming to you with their problems?
Well, I've gotten a lot of people contacting me, and I try to respond to them as best I can. On the other hand, I experience personally what it is to have a condition, a chronic debilitating condition, and to be told there was no hope. I had a botched back surgery and woke up from it unable to move my legs and in severe pain. And for 19 years, I lived in a very limited way. I could hardly walk more than four or five blocks without getting pain. I couldn't travel much and had couldn't play sports with my kids because the surgeon told me there was no hope. And then I met a very brash, in-your-face rehabilitation physician who told me that I was worshiping the volcano god of pain. I thought he was out of his mind. And he explained that I was interpreting pain, understandably, as a red flag, as danger. But his analysis was that the pain was coming from my muscles being so atrophied and my ligaments contracted, and he challenged the assumption that I had no hope. And at that moment, I felt hope for the first time. It was both frightening, because I thought, I'll go through his program and just have more pain. But on the other hand, it was tremendously empowering and uplifting. And I walked almost 2 miles this morning and swam, and I'm not completely back to being 27 years old again, but I'm much, much better. And so I think all physicians need to take the weight on their shoulders of hope.
Do you think because you were a physician that helped well up hope in you that there could be something better? Or does it not matter who you are for the hope?
It doesn't matter that much, I think. You're so vulnerable. You're so confused and fearful. I was incredibly fearful because you're suffering, just like the woman who called just before. And it's very hard to think clearly, and it's very hard to see hope. And if a doctor doesn't show it to you or doesn't say that it might even be there...
You don't get hope training in med school.
No. In fact, my mentor in medical school is a wonderful man who's in his 70s now, read the book, and he wrote me a beautiful note. And he said, you know, I realized we never taught you about hope. And we still don't teach about hope in an explicit way, and we really should.
Mm-hmm. It should be something as a course, something you have to teach.
Absolutely. And of course, it varies from person to person, so there's no trick or formula for hope.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and continue our conversation with Jerome Groopman, author of The Anatomy of Hope, How People Prevail in the Face of Illness. And we'll prevail on you to give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour with Jerome Groopman. He's a physician and author of The Anatomy of Hope, How People Prevail in the Face of Illness, just out from Random House. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Paul in Portland. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I just have a comment. I have to agree that it's interesting because I had a conversation with my mother about hope last night. My mother has not been dealing with a terminal illness, but she is the mother of 16 children. And it's because of hope that she's been able to make it through that trial. But it also relates to a situation with a coworker who just passed away from cancer. And it was because of hope that he was able to live the final days of his life with dignity. And I think there is a distinction between hope and optimism. Nobody was optimistic necessarily that they were going to make it through the trials, but they had a tremendous hope, and that hope was faith-based, but it was hope, not optimism. So I absolutely agree, and I think that it's also interesting that the book is titled Anatomy of Hope, because it reminds me a lot of Carolyn Miss's work, Anatomy of the Spirit, which is maybe not so science-based, but metaphysically based. Anyway, thank you for your work, and I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you, Paul. Dr. Groopman, any reaction?
I think the point that Paul makes reminds me of a woman, very wonderful woman named Barbara Wilson, who indeed had breast cancer. I cared for her for many years, and she wanted very much to live. And ultimately, we ran out of effective treatments. Mm-hmm. I came to her bedside towards the end of the day when things quiet down in the hospital. And I really adored this woman, very feisty, very lively woman. And I said, Barbara, you know, we've come to a point where I have no more medicine to give you. And she looked at me and she said, no, Jerry, you're wrong. You have the medicine of friendship. And what she meant by that was that the focus of hope for her was shifting away from her body, which she knew no longer could be saved, to her spirit, if you will, to her relationships, to things actually in her life that were unreconciled. And I think for people of faith, often faith is a source of hope at this time, but you don't have to be religious to have hope. There are other sources, love with family, gratification with your work, and as I write in the book, a sense of legacy, of memory, that you're going to leave something important behind that will change the future.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, in this day and age where doctors see their patients for such short periods of time, and they look for their physicians to give them hope or to talk about hope, how do doctors find time to do that? How do they find time to, like you, have a bedside manner and sit down with the, you know, a terminally ill patient?
It's very hard, and I don't hold myself up as some, you know, paragon of virtue. There are times when I'm very pressed and rushed and feel that I don't speak to hope as much as I should. But I feel we have to resist it. I think that it's so key, it's so important in people's lives, particularly people facing severe illness, that to shortchange them, to rush, you can't, you know, sort of move through the bed of a dying patient on roller skates. Or, you know, sort of give them an injection of hope. It doesn't work that way. It takes time, and we have to make the time.
Mm-hmm. What about the body-mind connection? And we hear about, you know, people now talking more about the placebo effect, you know, things like that, that actually have been shown now to have some sort of effect on people's outcomes.
Very much so. You know, placebo gives you a window to hope. It's different than hope, but it involves belief and expectation. It can release enormous amounts of endorphins in the brain and lower the amount of pain you're experiencing. And as I said before, pain can be a great obstacle to beginning a treatment or enduring one. Mm-hmm. It can increase motor function. There's a study in Science showing people with Parkinson's disease with belief and expectation release as much dopamine in their brain and have improved muscle function compared to people who are given a drug to release dopamine. Arthritis. It can improve muscle function and joint mobility, reduce pain, so they can undergo rehabilitation. So there are certain areas where science is sort of showing us that the mind-body connection is real. There's not a lot yet about immunology or cancer. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an open question. The flip side, as you say, the body-mind connection is very interesting. There is constant input from the tissues, from the organs to the brain, signaling sort of our body state of wellness or disease. And initial studies suggest, and certainly my clinical observations suggest, that negative input, a sense of sickness, of real debility, makes it very hard to generate hope, true hope. But there's almost a tipping point, and I write about this in the book, that when someone just begins to feel better, that relief from that negative input from the body to the brain can allow hope to blossom for the very first time.
So if you treat that condition, then, the symptoms, then they may feel better about themselves and be more hopeful.
Absolutely, and that hope then acts as in a domino effect because they will perhaps have less pain or better muscle function. So it's catalytic in a way.
Mm-hmm. You talked about a patient named Dan Conrad.
Right, very much. He's a very interesting guy. He's a Vietnam veteran, and he had a lymphoma, which was, to my mind, eminently curable. We had a real chance to cure him, a good chance to cure him. And so I came to his bedside with all of this military bravado, thinking because he was a vet, you know, I could say, and I did say, we're going to blast this tumor, we have the ammunition, we're in the trenches together. And the more I spoke that way, the more he retreated from me. He seemed unable to find hope. And it turned out that an army buddy of his had a lung cancer, a very different kind of cancer, very different biology, and had died just a terrible, pointless death with ineffective treatment. So he couldn't distinguish in his mind his condition, his lymphoma, from that of his friend. And a nurse did something very brilliant. When we finally convinced him to at least try treatment, I brought him into the chemotherapy clinic and just would sit him down at the first open chair. But the nurse led him to the far end of the room and sat him next to a woman who also had a lymphoma, the kind of cancer he had. And she was farther along in her treatment. She was almost cured. And he looked at her, and he could see in the present true hope, which was able to erase the memory of the past of his army buddy and allow him for the first time to envision a future for himself.
Mm-hmm. Are nurses better at instilling hope because they spend more time with the patients?
I think nurses are tremendous and often are better. They speak often more directly. They have the time of exposure. And to be self-critical, which I am, they often don't have the ego investment, that sometimes doctors, myself included, suffer from. So they can do wonders in terms of helping a person find and hold on to hope.
Mm. Let's see if I get one more call in before we have to go. Let's go to Mary in Milford, Indiana. Hi, Mary.
Yeah, hi. I guess I wonder what is the difference between faith and hope? Because if you go the other way around, then someone like, for instance, I've known someone already that through faith-based that they can't forgive, and therefore it's literally ruined their health. And how do you differentiate between real true hope and faith, or is it so close that it's intertwined?
Well, faith can mean different things. There's religious faith, which can be very positive. It can be a wellspring of hope, or like the woman I said, Esther Weinberg, with breast cancer, fundamentalist theology, which sees disease as punishment, can actually be counterproductive. Blind faith, so to speak, can be thought of as optimism. Oh, I'm going to get better. Everything is going to work out fine. I have faith. But that's not true. But faith that there's a possible solution is closer to true hope. And you don't need to be religious to have that. You can have some faith in the power of a medication or in the expertise of your physician or perhaps in the scientific establishment to make progress. It's no guarantee, but it can be an important source of true hope.
Thanks for calling, Mary. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Jerome Groopman, author of The Anatomy of Hope, How People Prevail in the Face of Illness, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Where do you go with all this knowledge now, Dr. Groopman? How do you pass it on to other doctors? How do you teach other physicians about hope? I mean, you said almost as much before that it's almost an art here to learn this.
It is an art, and I think there are two aspects to it. One is to recognize it. And I, as I write, fled from it because it looked soft and squishy, mm-hmm. and had this new age overlay of being a magic wand. And the second is that medicine is still very much an apprentice system, which means you need role models. You need physicians who understand the importance of hope and can show young doctors or medical students how critical it is. I was never brought in to these intimate conversations between doctor and patient where hope was being searched for. And I think we need to show people how senior physicians, competent physicians, can help and work with someone as a partner to find true hope. It needs to be part of a curriculum.
Is it the job of the physician to instill hope in patients so that they at least feel better about themselves while they're going through this trial?
I think if there's true hope for a clinical possibility, it is. Mm-hmm. Without hope, a person is lost. A person won't have the courage to try or the strength to endure. And therefore, this kind of sense of a tipping point or the possibility of having every advantage on your side is lost. I think it's absolutely essential. On the other hand, you can't make a person feel guilty about not having hope. You can't just switch hope on. And this is something which, unfortunately, is also in the popular literature. Oh, if you think positively, your cancer goes away. If it didn't go away, it meant you didn't have a strong enough character. You weren't capable of enough hope. And that's not true. Mm-hmm. So it's a very fine balance.
What about therapists? Is it important to bring therapists in to talk to some of these patients?
Very much so. Therapists, social workers, clergy, if someone's of religious faith, often they can probe deeply into corners of the psyche which the physician may not really be competent to or may not be knowledgeable in terms of the language, particularly in terms of religious beliefs.
I've got about a minute left. I want to ask you about this study out this month in the journal Cancer on the role of optimism in the survival of people with lung cancer. What do you think of that study?
Well, it's an important study in that it looks at the question of positive thinking, but it shows, I think, a lot of what we talked about in the past hour. One is that optimism is not hope. Interestingly, the patients were given false hope. The researchers state that in the article. They were told there was a radically better way of treating lung cancer. Turned out not to be true. Mm-hmm. And hope gives you the choice. You make decisions. The patients in the study had no choice about their treatment. They were randomly assigned to a therapy arm. So the soundbite in the media was hope has no effect on cancer. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we suffer from these soundbites. It's much more complicated than that.
All right. Let me thank you for taking time to join us this afternoon. Jerome Groopman is physician and author of The Anatomy of Hope, How People Prevail in the Face of Illness. He's the Dina and Raphael Racanati Chair of Medicine at the Harvard Medical School and Chief of Experimental Medicine at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Thanks again, Dr. Groopman. And good luck to you on the book. It's a great read. I recommend it highly to everyone who's interested in this topic.
Thank you, Ira. It's always a pleasure to be on this show.
Thank you. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galek and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Key Molesky and Alphonse Finn. If you have comments or questions, you can write to us the old-fashioned classic mail way if you'd like. Here's our address, Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com and leave us email there. Also, you'll find Science Friday's Kids Connection, which are free sets of curricula. Yes, we make free teaching materials out of Science Friday, and you can bring them into your schools and use Science Friday as a resource. Also, you can listen to back editions of Science Friday on Real Audio, or you can download them, join our audible.com, download them onto your iPod or your other Audible player. Also, you can, all the links we talked about, if you missed any of the links to Dr. Groopman's book or any of the topics we talk about on Science Friday, you can find them there on our website. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week on iRoflato in New York.